More than a million people in Illinois have health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. As congressional Republican leaders try to repeal the ACA, we ask, how will this affect health care in Illinois? We'll also hear from Democratic Representative Sherry Bustos.
I think there's this misperception that Medicaid is only for poor people. And, well, it's also the biggest funder of seniors and nursing homes in the nation.
And here in Illinois, the state could be in legal trouble for not reimbursing doctors quickly enough for Medicaid. WBEZ's Tony Arnold has more on who this could hurt the most.
Some doctors have been waiting 6 months for payments because the state's so far behind in paying its bills, and they're threatening to stop seeing low-income patients.
Later, what does public art mean to Chicago? Mayor Rahm Emanuel is calling 2017 the year of public art. Chicago Tribune architecture critic Blair Kamen tells us why and what public art he sees as being endangered throughout the city. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Yesterday, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell put on hold his plan to repeal and replace Obamacare. On Monday, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office predicted that plan would increase the number of people without insurance by 22 million over the next decade. Here in Illinois, we stand to lose about $40 billion in federal Medicaid funding over the next 10 years. This morning, a new poll out conducted by NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Marist finds that 55% of Americans say they disapprove of this plan. 17% say they approve, and a quarter say they haven't heard enough about it to have an opinion. Well, we're hoping today to provide you with some more information about how this would affect Illinois. We'll be speaking with the Illinois Hospitals Association, hearing from Democratic Representative of Sherry Bustos, and understanding more about Medicaid, including how much Illinois' fiscal state is affecting doctor and hospital reimbursements. As always, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think? What questions do you have? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21st Show. Again, our handle's 21ST Show. Let's start with what this means for Illinois' smaller cities. I'm joined now by Randy Dobie. He's CEO of Pinckneyville Community Hospital District. That's located about 30 miles north of Carbondale in southern Illinois. Randy, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Can you give us a sense, first of all, of how the Senate GOP health care bill with the proposed cuts to Medicaid would affect, for example, your hospital in Pinckneyville?
Yeah, for the rural communities such as us, and we're a 17-bed critical access hospital, and there's about 52 critical access hospitals in Illinois. It's going to be devastating in the fact that so it's going to be so much cuts to the Medicaid population, plus the people in the rural community are, you see those small farmers, small business owners that have a hard time even buying the insurance on the market, and then the Obama plan allowed them to do that, but they're going to see huge increases under this new law that's being proposed, which is going to make it very difficult for them to even afford to get on the insurance market to buy there. So it's going to be devastating to us for those people in a small rural community to be able to come to the hospital and be able to afford the health care that they deserve.
So are you saying that prior to Obamacare, were there people who were not able to afford health care who now have been able to in your area?
Yes, many people have been able to link up with the Obamacare and get on the plans. Now, well, there's been some disagreement about as far as how much premiums were and that some need to be changed, and that was part of the process of the Trump administration saying we're going to make it easier for people to get on the market share and make the premiums go lower. But this particular BCRA, we see the premiums are going to really go up, especially for the elderly population, which in the rural community, we are heavily volumed in rural elderly people.
And so what percentage of your patients are on Medicaid or Medicare, I imagine?
It varies by communities, but in our area, we're seeing about anywhere from 15% Medicaid. But as far as Medicare, it's very high. I mean, of course, people as they age, they're going to come more to the hospital services. But we're seeing anywhere from 50% of our patients being Medicare aged.
We heard a lot about Medicaid expansion, particularly in Illinois after Obamacare. Randy, I wonder how much that increased access to health care for patients in your area in southern Illinois.
Yeah, we saw a huge increase in the number of patients coming that actually have Medicaid because they and raised the limit up to 400% of the poverty level, which made a family of four up to $80,000 of income could actually get their family to come in and receive services here. So it's really helped as far as the number of people being serviced at the hospital actually come in and say, hey, I can afford to pay for my services now. And it's been a big difference to us. And when the Obama plan came into place, prior to that, they came to all the hospitals throughout the country and said, we want you guys to take a big cut in your finances, because with you taking that cut, we're going to make it easier for these people to be able to pay you, because they're going to either be on Medicaid or else they're going to be able to buy insurance products. And that will negate what cuts we make on the front end. Well, now with the new plan coming out by the GOP, they're going to cut those people for which we gave a big savings from the very beginning before Obama came in.
Mm-hmm. Randy, you know, we hear a lot about rural hospitals being on the brink of closure. Where would this bill push you guys in Pinckneyville? Where would it be for you? What would it mean for your hospital financially?
It's going to be worse the fact that we're in Illinois, and you've already heard the many troubles of the Illinois government and not having a budget now going on the third straight year. We're owed over $2 million as a smaller hospital just in state employees that's not been paid for over 2 years. Medicaid's paid 6 to 8 months behind. We get less than our cost. So this bill will actually make that even tougher for a state that's financially in dire straits as far as being able to get a budget. So we're going to see cash flow decreases. We're going to see our margins drop substantially, and it's going to make it very difficult for us to be able to provide many of the services we're doing. We have to look at some of the services we are providing that may be free or discounted and say, can we provide that any longer? So it's going to cut back on all the services we have to our communities, which we do a lot of those for free, you know, holding seminars, holding healthcare things for the community, but it's going to make it very difficult with the financial crunch we're going to see.
I've been speaking with Randy Dobie. He's the CEO of Pinckneyville Community Hospital District. That's about 30 miles north of Carbondale in southern Illinois. Let's bring someone else into this conversation. Danny Chun is the Vice President of Corporate Communications and Marketing for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. He's on the line with us from Naperville. Danny, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Nyla, for inviting Randy and me to talk about this important issue.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Danny. As you're hearing Randy talk about this, I wonder how representative you would say that situation is compared to other rural hospitals in Illinois.
Well, I think Randy did an excellent job of talking about the situation his hospital faces, and it's similar all across the state of Illinois. And if I were to describe in one word, devastating. And actually, the Senate bill is more damaging than the House bill in multiple ways, in terms of the damage it would do to Medicaid and in terms of the impact on premiums and out-of-pocket costs for Illinoisans who have coverage under the marketplace. So in many, many respects, it's worse. And obviously, the Illinois Health and Hospital Association is urging the Senate to reject the bill, and if the Senate does pass it, we would hope that the members of the Illinois House delegation would oppose it if it comes to the House.
And so, Danny, you're saying it's devastating for rural areas. Are you also saying it would be devastating for the entire state and for our cities and for even for the Chicago area?
Definitely. And let me just put it in perspective. I know a lot of numbers have been thrown around, and it's easy to get lost in the numbers, but basically this is all about people. Half the children in Illinois, half of all kids in Illinois are in Medicaid. One out of every four people in Illinois is covered by Medicaid. 60% of the elderly in nursing homes are covered by Medicaid. So a devastating impact on children, the elderly, the disabled, people in nursing homes. Oh, and by the way, people who have opioid addiction. Under the Medicaid expansion, under the ACA, for the first time, many people in Illinois are able to get treatment for opioid issues. And that would go away under the Senate bill.
I'm speaking with Danny Chun, who's with the Illinois Health and Hospital Association, along with Randy Dobie from Pinckneyville's Community Hospital District, just north of Carbondale. Danny, can I ask you, President Trump said you talked about Medicaid. You were sort of talking about people. President Trump's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, said on ABC this Sunday, she said, quote, if people are able-bodied and they want to work, then they'll be able to have employer-sponsored benefits like you and I have. Would you say that's an accurate description of people on Medicaid in Illinois?
I would say that's a very popular misconception and misnomer, and I'll try to be diplomatic in responding to Kellyanne's comments. 80% of the folks on Medicaid in Illinois are in a family that has at least one person in that family who's working. In the Medicaid expansion population, two-thirds of the folks who have coverage under the Medicaid expansion are working. There's a misnomer that Medicaid is for poor people who don't work, and that's absolutely not the case. It is a safety net for low-income working people. They just don't make enough in wages because they're in low-paying jobs to qualify for the marketplace, or, you know, they can't afford the marketplace and they qualify for Medicaid, or their employer does not provide employer-sponsored health coverage. So the majority of folks on Medicaid, they're working. And if they were able to have a better paying job, obviously they would try to have a better paying job. Anyone would. But they're in a situation where their income from their job is at a low level. They qualify for Medicaid.
Randy, what do you see at your hospital? Is that a reflection? Is that a reflection of what Danny's saying? I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that statement as well.
Yeah, we call them kind of the working poor. I mean, they are trying to work hard to make an income for their family, but health insurance takes a big chunk out of their budget. So the only way they can get it is through this Medicaid program. So the drastic cuts that this is going to be seen under the BCRA, as Danny said, is devastating to the fact that these people need that health insurance. If they have one or two children in their family that needs health care, they're going to stop coming to the hospital. They're going to quit going to seek out medical care because they no longer afford it. They just now got it through the Obama thing, and now here we're going to see some drastic cuts reversing where we were. So it will be devastating.
And so the BCRA is the Better Care Reconciliation Act. For everyone who's listening, that's the name of the GOP health care plan. Danny, I wonder if you could explain for us, we've heard a lot about caps. Can you explain a little bit more about this capped funding model and how Illinois hospitals might be affected by it?
Sure, and that's a great question, and I'll try not to be too wonky about it. Basically, right now, Medicaid is a shared program between the federal government and states all over the country. And it's based on what states spend for their Medicaid program to meet the needs of their residents. Now, under the Senate proposal, it would go to a capped funding model, which at first would be based on what's called the CPI medical plus 1%, I know I'm getting technical here, and then eventually toward 2025, it would go to a much lower inflation rate of CPI urban. What's important to know is it's a much lower rate than what actual medical costs are increasing at. So over time, massive costs would be shifted to the states like Illinois. And Illinois, as you know, is not well positioned to absorb any new financial burdens. Illinois is dead last in the country in federal funding support for Medicaid. We are the only state in the country that spends less than $5,000 per Medicaid beneficiary. And think about that. That's actually, in a way, very cost efficient. I don't think there's any private health plan that could cover somebody for less than $5,000 a year. But that's where Illinois is. Illinois would be permanently locked in to the low disadvantaged position of being 50th in the country at a super low federal funding support level. And we're not in any sort of position with the budget impasse, a $15 billion backlog in unpaid bills, including over $3 billion for Medicaid alone, and over $4 billion for state employee group health. We are just not in a position to absorb massive new costs because the federal government won't pay the states as much. So this is of great concern to the hospital community, and it should be to all residents and all patients in Illinois, because Illinois will be in the position of having to make some really difficult decisions, such as not covering as many people under Medicaid, cutting services that are covered, and reducing payments and reimbursements to doctors and hospitals, all of which will hurt patients because they won't be able to get the care they need when they need it.
And, Danny, we're talking about, this is 650,000 Medicaid payment patients in Illinois, correct, through 2021?
That's just under the Medicaid expansion, and more than $3.2 billion in total. One out of every four people in Illinois is covered by Medicaid. So the capped funding situation would affect all Medicaid patients, more than 3.2 million people in Illinois.
But we're going to, yeah, you know what, can I stop you for a second, Danny, because we've got to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation, not just about when we're talking about Medicaid, as Danny and Randy have pointed out, not just the federal situation, but the state situation with reimbursement. So we're speaking with Danny Chung from the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. Randy Dobie is also with us with the Pinckneyville Community Hospital District in Southern Illinois. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. If you have questions or comments, tweet them to 21STShow. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. Just after this short break, we're going to pick up this conversation about what proposed Republican changes to health care mean for the state of Illinois.
The 21st is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, generating new knowledge and developing and evaluating new technologies and methodologies to better distribute scholarly knowledge. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about how the Senate GOP health care bill would affect patients and hospitals in Illinois. On Monday, I spoke with Representative Sherry Bustos about this issue. She's a U.S. representative for Illinois' 17th congressional district, includes parts of Peoria, Rockford, and the Quad Cities. Representative Bustos, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
There's been a lot of movement this week on the Senate's proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act. What we've seen, I'm just thinking about what we've just seen even recently, the American Medical Association just putting out a statement saying that they feel like the Republican, the Senate version of this, violates the do no harm principle on many levels. Obviously, the Senate version is very different from the House version. I'm wondering what you think would, if there's anything that would you would see that would need to be included in this bill for you to support it if it gets back to the House?
I think the argument's all wrong that Mitch McConnell is throwing out there to the American public. Rather than say that we are going to repeal the Affordable Care Act and all the good that is part of that, let's take a look at the areas that are problematic under the Affordable Care Act. And as most people see it, those are two areas. Number one, the price of prescription drugs are too high for way too many families. It's causing people to get their prescriptions from their physician and to not be able to fill that because they can't afford it, or to take half the medication that's prescribed and not get the full benefit of that. And then number two, our copays and our deductibles and our premiums are way too high for too many people. But rather than just address those problematic areas, what this Trump Care bill does is it throws out the good components of the Affordable Care Act. You know, the fact that the folks with pre-existing conditions are going to have to go into these high-risk pools and basically face unaffordable health insurance in order to receive their care is unconscionable. And that was one of the major benefits of the Affordable Care Act, is that insurance companies could no longer discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. I mean, a major reason I decided to run for Congress was because my brother had cancer, and literally within a week after the 2010 election that was all focused on repealing the Affordable Care Act, my brother died. And, you know, I know what he had to go through and how his insurance wouldn't cover his care. And I know that that's happening to families all over the country. And it shouldn't happen like that. People don't choose to be sick. They don't choose to have a birth defect with their children. They don't choose to have cancer or heart disease. And what this Trump Care bill does, both the House version and the Senate version, is it hurts way too many families. Would knock off somewhere between 20 and 23 million Americans off their health insurance plans. So this is something that's very hard for families in our region to take, and once again, we're going to have a fight on our hands.
So it sounds like obviously the pre-existing conditions has gotten a lot of attention. I wonder what you think would be, in terms of what's being proposed now, what's most concerning to you for people in Illinois? Is it what the proposals are for Medicaid and for CAPS? Or I wonder what you think what to you is the most concerning thing apart from the pre-existing conditions?
Well, the list is fairly long. In my congressional district alone, there would be more than 43,000 people that would lose their health insurance under this plan. And if we want to look at it even from just an economic perspective, in the state of Illinois, there would be about 60,000 lost jobs as a result of this.
That's under the House. That's under the House plan, correct?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Right.
But keep in mind that if we all follow our civics lesson, we've got the House version. There'll be the Senate version, and if it passes out of the Senate, we'll have to come back and work out these differences.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked with families all over my congressional district. Who are very concerned about the pre-existing conditions. You brought up Medicaid. I think there's this perception that Medicaid is only for poor people, and if you're middle income, well, that just doesn't impact you. Well, it's also the biggest funder of seniors and nursing homes in the nation. About 80% of seniors who are in nursing homes, their fees are covered through Medicaid. And so, let's just look at even our region of the state of Illinois at large. And if you think about our loved ones who are seniors in nursing homes, the vast majority of that is paid for through Medicaid. And this Senate version would be devastating to the Medicaid program.
Representative Sherry Bustos, thank you for taking the time to join us. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
I should add, we reached out to four Republican representatives from Illinois, Representatives Rodney Davis, Representatives Holmgren, Shimkus, and Kinzinger. Three declined. One did not respond to our request for an interview to talk to them about their opinions about what's going on in the Senate right now. My guest on the line with me from Naperville, Danny Chun, is Vice President of Corporate Communications and Marketing, spokesman for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. Also on the line with us from Southern Illinois is Randy Dobie, who's CEO of Pinckneyville Community Hospital District. Danny, I just wanted to give you a chance to, before the break, we were talking about Medicaid. We heard Representative Bustos talking about that again. I just wanted to give you a chance to finish that thought that you were explaining about Medicaid and the one out of four people in Illinois who stand to be affected by this.
Right. And just to put a finer point on what's happening with the Medicaid expansion, Illinois would be affected much sooner than most other states in the country because we have a special trigger provision in a law that was passed in 2013 that would automatically kick everybody off Medicaid from the expansion population as of January 1, 2021. So we have 650,000 people now covered under the expansion. They would lose coverage under the Senate bill as of January 1, 2021. I wanted to touch on a very important point that the Congresswoman made about how this affects everybody, and I want to turn to the marketplace for one quick second. Both the Congressional Budget Office and Kaiser Family Foundation issued major reports, and these are both nonpartisan organizations that are well respected in terms of their analysis. Everyone at the low income levels and at the older age levels would face dramatic increases in their premium and out-of-pocket costs under the Senate bill. And let me just give you a quick example. In the Congressional Budget Office analysis, if you are a 64-year-old individual making a decent living, making an annual income of about $58,000 a year, your annual premium would triple, and this is after tax credits are taken into account, to more than $20,000 a year, probably making health insurance coverage unaffordable for that person. That's just an example. Rural counties in Illinois would face dramatic increases ranging anywhere from 144% to 588%, a nearly six-time increase if you're making $20,000 a year in a small rural town in Illinois. Again,
yeah.
I don't think that's affordable coverage.
And Danny, as you mentioned that, I wanted to go back to Randy and ask you, Randy Dobie with Pinckneyville. I wanted to actually bring up something else that you brought up earlier, Randy, where you said your hospital district was owed $2 million by the state. Is that that's also for Medicaid reimbursements, Randy?
That's for state employees that we haven't been paid over 2 years because with the court ordering payment of Medicaid claims, then the state just quit paying for employees of the state. So that's just accounting just what is owed to us for state employees, which are not getting paid at all.
And has the state been prompt in paying for services provided to Medicaid patients?
Illinois generally ranges from 6 to 8 months out when they pay. So if you have a date of service now, we can look forward to a payment in 6 to 8 months down the road. And we know the payments are not at a – it's below cost, so there's a loss already when we receive a payment.
Okay. But in that, is that still keeping on track? Even with the impasse, you're still getting about 6 to 9 month reimbursement rates from the state?
That's about what we're seeing now. Now, depending on what happens here with the state budget and the current lawsuit that's going on with the state of Illinois, we'll see where that all pans out. So I'm still waiting for a final decision on that for the coming year.
Yeah, let's bring someone else into this conversation who's been covering that issue in particular. Tony Arnold is a reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. He's been reporting on that case Randy was just mentioning. It's an ongoing federal court case, which a judge is expected to rule whether Illinois must prioritize payments to Medicaid providers. Hey, Tony, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla.
Tony, when are we expecting to hear this ruling? Was that this morning, today? When are we supposed to hear about this?
The judge had a brief hearing this morning in Chicago, and the short answer is Friday is the new deadline. It basically got punted for about 48 hours here to figure out what, you know, as Randy was saying, it's 6 to 8 months that he's waiting for reimbursements on Medicaid from the state. The decision's been made already by the judge that that's going to be – you're going to get state money sooner than 6 to 8 months. The question is how much sooner, and that's where there's some disagreement and drama actually a little bit playing out in this case at this point.
Right. So the judge ordered the state to move faster to reimburse doctors and hospitals, but is it doing anything to enforce that?
What the judge is saying is she's telling the state, the attorneys for the state of Illinois and the attorneys who represent Medicaid patients to figure it out on their own. If they can't, then she will make a decision for them. And that's where the issue's coming in, is that the attorneys are saying, we've tried, we haven't found an agreement on what's an appropriate wait time for hospitals like Randy's. That's where it is, right? The attorneys for Medicaid patients are basically saying, they want $1 billion for each of the next 4 months. And the state of Illinois says that's unaffordable. We can't match that. They're saying something around $75 million that they could do for in each month. That hasn't been going so far. So very different numbers. I don't know what the middle ground is going to be. It looks right now like the federal judge is going to have to make the decision on behalf of the state.
Danny, what's the Illinois Health and Hospitals Association's position on this in terms of how long, first of all? Let's start with what Tony said about wait times.
And let's put this in perspective. Tony mentioned that one number that's being talked about to bring down the backlog is $75 million. The backlog, I believe, and Tony can correct me, I believe the backlog that's been stated in court is now over $3.2 billion. So that plays into how fast can the state pay down that backlog.
Right.
$75 million, that's not very fast.
Yeah, Tony, it's about 3.5 in Medicaid payments, and then is there another $4 billion in state group health, meaning state employees? Is that about right for the numbers, Danny and Tony?
The state employee health is not part of this lawsuit. That's a
correct
number.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been growing. I'll say that. Last I heard, it was actually $2 billion, but I think it's definitely been growing because the state hasn't had a budget to actually appropriate and map out how much money Medicaid's going to cost, and that's the whole reason that this is even going on at this point.
Mm-hmm. And when we think about that, Randy, I wonder for you. You originally said $2 million. Is that a combination of both Medicaid? I'm sorry, the $2 million you said is just for state workers, correct?
Just state workers,
so,
yes.
And then how much are you behind on Medicaid for your hospital?
I think we looked at that the other day, and it's close to that, the $1.2 million for us. And again, we're a small critical access hospital, so those numbers are substantially bigger as you go up to the larger size of hospitals. But it's an enormous amount of money for our bottom line as a smaller hospital to be able to survive in a state of Illinois that's basically not paying the bills to begin with very timely. And we have to pay our consumers, you know, where our supplies come from, and we can't sometimes afford to pay them on time as well. And they're calling us, say, hey, when are you going to pay your bills? Well, when the state pays ours, you know. So.
Yeah, Randy, how do you handle that? I mean, and what kind of cuts and things do you do? I mean, I'm at a loss to think of how you manage
something prime
like
vendors,
this.
Certain prime vendors, you know, we have to keep up. Like when we buy medications from medication companies, they are a prime vendor. We have to have those supplies. But, you know, can we hold back on some of the other things like a door or a new cabinets or stuff like that? Put off some of the capital purchases to make sure they're paying your timely bills. So that's kind of, you have to work the process to where you're paying them that has to be done, and then kind of holding off on expenditures that you can back off, which a lot of the small hospitals are doing that pretty heavily. There's some critical access hospitals in the state of Illinois that are in very, very financial dire needs that have negative margins for the last several years, and this is going to compound that to the point where you're going to see hospital closures if this continues.
And Nyla, can I just jump in for a second?
Go for it. Go ahead, Danny.
More than 40% of hospitals all across Illinois, including in small and rural towns, more than 40% of hospitals across the state are either losing money or barely making it. So they're already financially challenged and face a really difficult situation with the state budget situation. So that's why Illinois Health and Hospital Association supports prioritizing Medicaid payments to providers, that those payments be at a higher priority for the state. It's got to be a priority.
Tony, basically what you said is that you said the idea is that we'll have this ruling Friday will be expected. What is the judge? We just have about a minute left, Tony. I wonder if you just could quickly summarize for us what we're expecting to hear from the judge.
The judge is going to have to decide what the right dollar amount is that the state's going to be reimbursing hospitals from Medicaid. And without an agreement from the attorneys, that number could be, in short, a very substantial number, which means... And honestly, the comptroller for Illinois has said that she doesn't have that much more extra money, which means she's going to have to dig into something else to pay for the hospitals, which again gets to the whole mess that this budget impasse is causing. And this could change sort of the circumstances of this whole impasse, because it would mean maybe schools don't get that money. Maybe pensions don't get that money. Maybe state employees have to wait longer. That's the question right now, and on Friday, I think this impasse is going to have a different shape based on the judge's decision.
That's WBEZ political reporter Tony Arnold telling us more about this crucial case on Friday. I want to thank Danny Chun with the Illinois Health and Hospital Association and Randy Dobie also giving us the perspective from Pinckneyville Community Hospital District in Southern Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you for helping spread, hopefully everybody learning a little bit more about what healthcare looks like in Illinois right now.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. From the Bean in Millennium Park to the Picasso near Daly Plaza, Chicago's a city that's known not just throughout Illinois but the world for its public art. And this year, 2017, Mayor Rahm Emanuel has proclaimed to be the year of public art in Chicago. This year, the city's commissioned dozens of local artists to create new sculptures, murals, and other public art pieces in all 50 wards of the city. It's a $1 million investment in artist-led community projects. It's all going to be highlighted during the month of October at a citywide public art festival. Blair Kamen is the architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune. He's in studio with me now at Northwestern's MacDill School of Journalism in downtown Chicago to talk about this. Hey, Blair, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Nala. It's great to be here.
You know, I'm thinking about this. When I first moved to Chicago from Miami, to go to Northwestern, to go to MacDill, it was during the Cows on Parade public art exhibit. And I just remember being so awed by it because I think prior to that, I was thinking about this when I was preparing for our conversation this morning. And I think prior to that, the only public art that I knew as a kid was when the crazy French artist Christo, he had like wrapped all the islands in Miami in pink plastic, which is sort of weird. But it got me thinking a lot about the concept of public art and how, especially for children, that's probably maybe their first sort of encounter with art, public art throughout the city. And I wanted to ask you about that and sort of what role you think public art plays in, especially here in Chicago.
Public art plays a big role in civilizing the city. When you think about architecture and art, what's the difference between them? Buildings shape space. They act together or they form walls, like the wall of skyscrapers along Wacker Drive or along Grand Park. Sculpture animates space. It puts creatures into space. It might be a flamingo, like we see in the Federal Plaza by Alexander Calder. It might be the Cows on Parade. It might be a general on horseback, or it might be a deer, like the deer, the larger-than-life-size deer that just showed up on the Riverwalk as part of this public art celebration. So that's the essential distinction. Architecture creates the environment. Sculpture populates it.
And when we think about that, there's something also, I think, about the ephemeral nature of public art in mm-hmm. some cases, right, that yeah. makes a big difference in the city as well. Because, and I'm thinking in particular of the walk you made to go from Tribune Tower across the bridge here. There's sort of that space in front of downtown Chicago between Tribune Tower and the NBC building where there's been, I think, everyone that's been a little controversial how good that public art has been, right? I think lots of visitors to Chicago remember the Marilyn Monroe statue that was there for a long time. Now it's a kind of an interesting Lincoln. How would you describe what
Abraham
is,
Lincoln like and some guy in sneakers?
Yeah. Okay, there we go. That's a good way to describe it.
I mean, the vulnerability, the temporary nature of public art and its vulnerability is also on display this year. And that's not something you're hearing about from the city of Chicago, which is just touting, you know, public art and how great the Emanuel administration is and how great the city is. For example, earlier this year, just a few months ago, Alexander Calder's Universe, a mobile mechanized sculpture in the lobby of Willis Tower, disappeared. It was dismantled.
And that had been there forever.
That had been there since Willis Tower opened.
Yeah. It
had
been Sears Tower. We should.
Yes,
I like
correct.
That you say it's not. You're the architect. Okay, of course, you have to say Willis Tower.
Yeah,
everyone
no,
else will
but
say
it was,
Sears
no,
Tower.
But it was then Sears Tower. Right. Absolutely. So, in other words, there was an ownership dispute over that piece, and the it's complicated. But previous owners of Sears Tower, it's thought, had the piece removed, and so this whimsical, colorful piece that animated this kind of tall, rather cold and austere lobby just vanished. Then just this week, recently, we learned about a piece of a mural in Pilsen that was a beloved piece of public art. And developers just graywashed it.
Right. I saw that, and I saw the sort of the outrage, particularly from a lot of artists that I know, but just a lot of people talking about that on social media.
It's stunning.
So that's what you mean by vulnerability. When you say vulnerability, you mean because the public art is contingent on different commercial, like people who own the building or other commercial interests.
It's contingent upon the changing taste and the whims of owners of buildings. Another good example was there was a wonderful Henry Moore piece in the lobby of 3 First National Plaza in Chicago. It was there for many years. Tourists still come to see it. They ask the security guards where it is. It's not there anymore. It was moved to England a few years ago when the developer decided to redo the lobby. So, I mean, people have visceral, emotional attachments to
whether they love them or they hate them, they are visceral, aren't
right.
they?
They're yeah. like people. They're like creatures. They you know, they really, if they're good, they get to us in some way. And ideally, if they're really good, we form attachments to them over the years. So when they disappear, it's like a beloved, you know, friend or feature of the cityscape has just vanished. And you say, why? What the hell's going on here?
I'm speaking with Blair Kamen, architecture critic at the Chicago Tribune, and we're talking about public art in Chicago. And when you say that about pieces in particular, the Picasso celebrated its 50th anniversary
right.
this year. And I love the line you had in your column. You wrote, then Mayor Richard J. Daley introduced this. This is in 1967, right? By saying, we dedicate this celebrated work with the belief that what is strange to us today will be familiar tomorrow, which is, yeah, really good. That's a really good aspiration, and turns out, for that Picasso piece, which I think anyone who's driven by or been, or I mean, I feel like anyone who's made any trip to Chicago has seen that. And then there's so many folks working around the Daley Center who see that piece. How did that piece kick off the whole notion of public art in Chicago?
That piece was commissioned from Picasso by a Chicago architect, William Hartman, who was very civic-minded. He traveled to Europe to meet with Picasso, and you know, he got Picasso to do this piece late in his career. And once that was there, it kind of was this way of breathing life into the Loop, which at that point was this kind of forest of skyscrapers. So the Picasso adorned this big plaza, this clearing in the forest, as it were, of open space. It, you know, in this clearing in the forest, there was this kind of inscrutable creature who might have looked like a basset hound.
Inscrutable to a lot of people,
yes.
I have to say, Blair.
yeah. You know, angel's wings, a woman's face. It's certainly subject to interpretation. But all of a sudden, you know, this kind of became fashionable. And so then the General Services Administration, when it developed the Federal Center a few years later in the 1970s, commissioned Alexander Calder, one of the great sculptors of the 20th century, to do the flamingo. And the flamingo is just great. It's this vermilion-colored piece, Calder red, with curving steel that contrasts vividly with a kind of right-angled matte black architecture of the Mies van der Rohe buildings at the Federal Center. It's a fabulous counterpoint between the two. And it's interactive, like the Picasso. It isn't just a general on horseback that you walk around. You can walk through it. So it kind of anticipates, through its interactivity, features like the public sculptures like the Bean and the Crown Fountain that are really interactive, especially the Crown Fountain, where, you know, one can get a shower from the spitting
that's
gargoyles.
True interaction. And the Bean, which its official name, which everyone calls it, the Bean.
Right.
But I wonder, when we're thinking about this year of public art, mm-hmm. with Mayor Emanuel, there are the sculptures and the pieces that are iconic to Chicago, certainly, I think the Bean is sort of it in terms of tourists and coming downtown.
Yeah.
What is the hope that we'll see through neighborhoods throughout the Chicago with this year of art?
I think that the hope is that the pieces in the neighborhoods will create centers of, you know, visual focuses, centers of identity. pieces that have the same sort of resonance that the destroyed Pilsen mural did in its neighborhood. I read a story today from the Sun-Times that people in Pilsen actually met last night, and you know they were angry and they want to like repaint that mural and recreate that mural. So I think that
can we talk for a minute just about the role of murals in neighborhoods like Pilsen?
Sure.
Because I think that's a part of public art that maybe people who aren't as familiar with the city might not see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those murals were a vehicle for immigrant groups to, you know, express their identity, literally paint their identity on the walls of, buildings. And they kind of layer on this identity on old Chicago residential or commercial buildings. And they just have great resonance over time because it's like their flag. It's like their identity. So the loss of it, people were literally laying flowers at the base of this mural that had been graywashed, as though like someone had died. I think that, ideally the neighborhood pieces are not what is often called derisively plop art. You know, just take it, make it, drop it in.
Right, doesn't reflect the neighborhood. It's people
That it engages in some way with the character of the neighborhood. And you know, that doesn't mean it has to blandly reflect the neighborhood. It might be provocative. But ideally it has some link, some connection. It isn't just dropped in by an artist, who might have dropped it in somewhere else in another part of the city.
I wonder, what are your favorite pieces of public art in Chicago?
Well, as I've said, I love the Calder.
Yeah.
I love the Bean. I mean, who doesn't?
Who doesn't
right?
Love the Right?
Yeah, that's
I think that's a pretty universal, right?
That's pretty easy, I have to admit.
Right.
I also love the Chagall mosaic that is at the Chase Plaza. This is this piece that looks, it has the kind of delicacy of, peanut brittle or something. And it's this wonderful, very long wall of surrealistic sculpture by Chagall in which he depicts life in Eastern Europe, in Chicago. There are all these images of families, of lovers. It's right up against this skyscraper that looks like a ski slope. You know, it's like 50 or 60 stories tall. It kind of curves down to the bottom. And you've got this, piece, again, contrasting with the architecture that's, these beautiful little mosaic pieces that kind of have this jewel-like quality to them. And, these pieces just, they humanize the city. It's they're like the cows, like the deer. They're either creatures or they have messages, and they are more in – they're not necessarily human-scaled, but they're more human-scaled than, Willis Tower, the second tallest building in the country. So I think they become really – they really enrich the cityscape, and they enrich our experience of passing through it.
Speaking of that vulnerability, one last question I wanted to ask you about before we wrap. The Thompson Center, it's been sort of controversial. We're kind of in this back and forth phase. Is it going to be sold? Is it not?
Right.
That's another question about some art there.
Absolutely. There's a Jean Dubuffet sculpture in front of the Thompson Center. Monument with Standing Beast is the name of it. And
who owns that?
Well, the State of Illinois Museum controls it. And they had been making contingency plans about possibly relocating it to another site if the Thompson Center were to be demolished, were to be sold and then demolished. Now, Governor Rauner and Mayor Emanuel's deal about the sale of the Thompson Center fell through. So for the present, the Thompson Center is safe, and so is the Dubuffet. But like all public art, it may wind up being vulnerable, and it may wind up being moved. We'll see.
That's the Chicago Tribune's architecture critic, Blair Kamen. We'll tweet out a few of the columns he's wrote recently this year about public art, but I want to thank him for being with us. Blair, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
No, it was a pleasure. Great to talk to you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. You do have to have NPR One enabled. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to send us a voicemail, if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. That's all at our website, 21stshow.org. Speaking of social media, our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background on what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo, broadcasting today from the Medill Dunes Room in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.